It was miserably small, and promised little for my comfort during the days ahead. A candle glowed red in the indescribable atmosphere. I stumbled over a tangle of legs and brought the hovel to life by the magic word, relief. A string of curses proceeded from a hole like a baker's oven, and then one by one emerged an unshaven face, a pair of battered shoulder straps, a weather-beaten uniform, and two clods of earth in which, presumably, boots were concealed. We sat down at a so-called table and went through the business of handing over, in which each tried to do the other in to the tune of a dozen iron rations and a few very light pistols. My predecessor was then disgorged into the open through the narrow entry, prophesying, as he went, that the rotten hole would not last out another 3 days. I remained inside, the new captain of Sector A. I surveyed our trench next morning and found little to cheer me. I had scarcely left the dugout when I met two coffee carriers bleeding from wounds inflicted by shrapnel bullets in the communication trench. A few steps further, Fusilier Ahrens reported to me with a hit from a ricochet. We had the village of Boucoy in front of us and Pissieu-Aumont behind. The company was without support in a front line that was both shallow and narrow, and we were separated from the 76th Infantry Regiment on our right by a large, unoccupied gap. The left flank of the regimental front comprised a piece of splintered woodland, known as Wood 125. By orders, no deep dugouts were excavated. The men were accommodated two at a time in little dugouts held up by so-called Ten Siegfrieds. As my dugout was situated behind quite another part of our front, the next thing I did was to seek new quarters. A hut-like affair in a length of trench that had fallen in seemed to me to meet the case when I had put it into a defensible state by collecting a few lethal instruments there. Once installed, I lived a hermit's life among fields of green, disturbed only by an occasional runner or orderly who carried the paper war even into this retired spot. One was able then to shake one's head between two shell bursts over many matters of grave importance, such as that the town major of X had lost a terrier with black spots answering to the name of Zippy, if one had not lost oneself with savage humor in the suit for maintenance of the servant girl McCaben against Corporal Mager. The proformas and returns, too, provided us with needful distraction. One was kept so fully occupied with the inner organization that time was scarcely left over for the little affair of holding the line. And indeed one was asked little about it. It often appeared that collecting empty cartridge cases was of far greater importance. Whenever the visit of a superior officer was announced, I hurried along the trench collecting paper and cartridge cases, and instructing the men on guard how they were to report themselves and click their heels together. Also that they were not to commit the crime of averting their eyes from the enemy in the course of the operation, though not even the tip of the enemy's nose had been seen for 3 months past, nor even to let their rifles out of their hands. The sure reward was 3 days' solitary confinement. These things were typical of us and did much harm. The letter stifled the spirit. The war was bureaucratized. At the same time, the front-line officer had far too much discipline in his bones to raise these matters, though they were the object of curses in every platoon commander's dugout. Yet it was for him to fuse the old Prussian spirit with the methods of modern warfare. To return to my dugout, to which I gave the fine name, Wanfried House, its roof was my only worry, for it could only be described as relatively shell-proof, that is, only so long as it was not hit. However, I comforted myself with the thought that I was no worse off than the men. Every afternoon my batman put a blanket down in an immense shell hole approached by a sap we had excavated, and there I had a sunbath. My siesta was, I confess, frequently interrupted by the bursts of shells nearby or the whiz of bomb splinters when we were bombed from the air. We were often heavily shelled at night. I lay on my bunk on a mattress of fresh grass and listened with a quite peculiar and a quite ungrounded sense of security to the shells falling around, while the soil descended in showers at each shock. Or else I went outside and looked from the firestep across the sad night landscape that was in such strange and indescribable contrast to the fiery spectacle whose dance floor it was. At such moments there crept over me a mood I had never known before, a certain falling off of the fighting spirit, a war-weariness occasioned by the length of time I had been exposed to the war's excitements. Nothing but war and danger, not a night that was not convulsed with shells. The seasons succeeded each other. Winter came, and then summer, and one was always in the war. Tired of it and used to it, one was all the more dispirited and fed up with it just because one was used to it. One was blinded no longer by appearances. The war had raised deeper problems of its own. It was a singular time. The front line had comparatively little to suffer from the enemy fire. Otherwise it would have been untenable. It was pursue and the hollows near it that were chiefly and almost continuously shelled, and in the evenings the bombardment rose to quite extraordinary intensity. Ration parties and reliefs were consequently very risky matters. On the 14th of June I was relieved at 2 in the morning by Kius, who also had returned and was in command of the 2nd Company. We spent our time on rest behind the railway embankment at Achier-le-Grand, which gave shelter to our huts and dugouts. The English shelled time after time with heavy, low-trajectory shells. The quartermaster sergeant of the 3rd Company, Rackerbrandt, fell a victim. A few days before this there had been an appalling disaster. A bomb had been dropped in the midst of the band of the 76th, while a crowd stood round listening. There were many of the 73rd, too, among the casualties. There was a cluster of shell-shot tanks quite close to the embankment, and I often went to look at them. They bore names that were sometimes humorous, sometimes defiant, and sometimes affectionate, and they were camouflaged with paint. But they were all in a pitiable plight. The little cabin of armored plate, now shot to pieces with its maze of pipes, rods, and wires, must have been an extremely uncomfortable crib during an attack, when the monsters, hoping to baffle the aim of our guns, took a tortuous course over the battlefield, like gigantic helpless cockchafers. I thought more than once of the men in these fiery furnaces. On the morning of the 18th, the 7th Company had to return to Pussieu on account of the uncertain state of affairs there, to be at the disposal of the CO of the troops in the line for carrying parties or any other purpose. We occupied cellars and dugouts on the edge of the village nearest Bukoy. Just as we arrived, a salvo of heavy shells went up in the surrounding gardens. In spite of this, I did not refrain from breakfasting in a little arbor at the entrance of my dugout. After a while, there was another of them, so I made a dash for it. It went up quite close. A stretcher-bearer of my company, named Kenziora, who was passing by with some dixies of water, was hit in the lower part of the body. As we bound him up, great drops of sweat stood on his forehead, and when I tried to comfort him, he groaned out, "It is a mortal wound. I can tell that well enough." In spite of this prophecy, I shook him by the hand 30 years later on our entry into Hanover. In the afternoon I took a solitary walk through Puisieux. The village had already been pounded to a heap of ruins by the Somme battle, and now shell holes and wreckage of walls wore a mantle of green from which the white discs of the ruin-loving elder shone out on every side. Numerous more recent bursts had made rents in this mantle, and once more laid bare the soil of the gardens so often churned up already. The village street was fringed with the refuse of the advance now come to a standstill. Shell-shot wagons, abandoned ammunition, the weapons of hand-to-hand fighting, skeletons of half-decayed horses surrounded by the hum of myriads of flies, all told of the vanity of all things in the fight for life. The church that occupied the highest point in the village consisted of nothing now but a dreary heap of stones. While I picked a bunch of wonderful roses in a waste garden, a few shells came to remind me of prudence in this dancing place of death. After a few days, we relieved the 9th Company in the line of resistance, about 500 meters behind the front line. 3 of my men were wounded in the course of the relief. Captain von Lederboer was wounded in the foot next morning by a shrapnel bullet close to my dugout. Though far gone in consumption, he felt that fighting was his vocation. It was his fate to succumb to this slight wound. He died soon after in hospital. On the 28th, Sergeant Gruner, who was in charge of my ration party, was hit by a shell splinter. This was the 9th casualty in the company within a few days. After we had been a week in the front line, we had again to occupy the line of resistance, since our relief battalion was pretty well disbanded owing to Spanish influenza. With us, too, several men reported sick daily. Influenza was so severe in the neighboring division that an enemy flyer dropped a pamphlet to say that the English would undertake the relief if the troops were not taken out soon. We heard, all the same, that the malady was spreading more and more on the other side, too. With us the effects were worse owing to undernourishment, and in addition we were kept in constant readiness for an attack, as Wood 125 was being shelled incessantly with an intensity that boded no good. The 6th Company, who were in the line there, were many of them down with carbonic oxide poisoning. Some were only saved by an oxygen apparatus. One afternoon, while walking along the trench, I found several buried cases of English ammunition, and blew off the tip of my right forefinger through foolishly taking a rifle grenade to pieces. The same evening, while I stood talking to Lieutenant Sprenger on the top of my dugout, a heavy shell went up close to us. We argued over the distance it was from us, and Sprenger estimated it at 10 meters, I at 30. In order to see how far I could rely on myself in such matters, I measured it, and found the shell hole 22 meters away from where we were standing. People are very apt to underestimate distances. On the 20th of July, I was again with my company at Puisieux. I spent the whole afternoon standing on the ruins of a wall and watching the front line, where, it seemed to me, something very suspicious was going on. Wood 125 was often veiled in the smoke of violent shelling, while green and red lights were rising and falling. Often the artillery fire was silent, and then the tack-tack-tack of a machine gun could be heard, and the faint reports of distant bombing. From where I stood, the whole thing was like a pretty game. It had not the majesty of the first-class battle, and yet the relentless strife between two brazen forces was there to see. All over the empty expanse there were hidden eyes fixed on the little wood, round whose shuddering oak tops fountains of brown earth danced in ever-changing figures. All round, distributed in trenches, shell holes, caverns, and ruins, were men and guns, awaiting their turn in the battle for a piece of ground covered with splintered trunks. Far behind, at opposite poles, two generals are seated at tables spread with maps. There is a report, a brief exposition, a few words to a staff officer, a conversation on the telephone. An hour later, a fresh bombardment tears up the old shell holes, and a fresh hecatomb of men bleeds in the suffocating fumes. Towards evening I was summoned to the headquarters of the troops in reserve, and there learned that the enemy had got a footing on the left flank of our trench system. In order to make a little room in front of us again, the order was that Lieutenant Peterson, with the Storm Company, was to clear the hedge trench that ran along the side of the wood, and I, with my fellows, the communication trench running parallel to it in a hollow of the ground. We moved off at dawn. But before we left our jumping-off place, the rifle fire became so violent that we abandoned the enterprise for the time. I gave orders to occupy the Elbinger Alley, and made up for my broken night's sleep in an immense cavern of a dugout. At 11 in the morning I was awakened by the noise of bombs from the left flank, where we held a block. I hurried to the spot and found the usual scene in this description of fighting. White clouds of bomb smoke hanging over the trench, and a few traverses back, a machine gun rattling from either side, while in between there were men bending forward and jumping now forward, now back. The little coup de main was already beaten off, but it had cost one man who lay behind the block, torn by bomb splinters. Towards evening I had orders to lead the company back to Pursue, and then, on arrival, I was ordered to take two sections and join in rolling up the trench in the hollow. At 3:40 we, that is to say, Lieutenant Voigt of the Storm Company with a storm troop, and I with my two sections, set off for the starting point. Our instructions were to roll up the trench from the Red Point K to Red Point Z after a 5 minutes artillery and trench mortar preparation. I cannot deny that both of us considered the artillery preparation, and in fact the taking and occupying of the trench, as unnecessary and ill-judged. The trench lay in the bottom of the hollow and was overlooked from all sides. The decisive point was the hedge trench. If an attack was to be made, it was essential to take it, and it automatically gave possession of the hollow. I cherished the firm suspicion that this operation had been ordered from the rear and by the map, for it could not have occurred to anyone who had seen the lie of the land to give such orders as these. After the artillery preparation, which cost us one man wounded, we advanced and rolled up the trench. Shortly before two, we encountered opposition and bombed our way through it. As we had gained our objective and were not disposed for further fighting, we made a block and posted a section with a machine gun behind it. The only pleasure I had in the affair was the behavior of the men of the storm troop, who reminded me forcibly of Grimmelhausen's Simplicissimus. These young warriors, with great shocks of hair and putties, fell into a hot dispute 20 meters from the enemy because one of them had called the other a rabbit. They cursed like troopers and vaunted themselves with mighty boasts. "Look here, we are not all such funks as you," one of them shouted at last, and rolled up 50 meters of trench by himself. By midday the section holding the block came back. They had had casualties and could hold out no longer. I had already given them up for lost and was surprised that anyone at all had been able to pass along this trench and still be alive. That is what comes of war on paper. In spite of our counter-attacks, the enemy still had a firm footing on the left flank of our front line, and in the strongly barricaded communication trenches, and so threatened our support line. On the 24th of July, I went to the new C sector of the support line to find my way about, as I was to take it over on the next day. I got Lieutenant Gipkins, commanding the new company, to show me the block at the hedge trench, and sat down beside him on a fire step. Suddenly Gipkins seized hold of me and pulled me to one side. Next moment a shot flew into splinters on the very place where I had been sitting. By a lucky chance he had seen a rifle barrel slowly pushed forward out of a loophole in the block only 40 meters from us. The keen eye of an artist had saved my life, for any fool could have hit me at that range. I was told later that 3 men of the 9th Company had already been shot through the head at this apparently harmless spot. In the afternoon I was tempted from my coal hole by some not particularly violent artillery fire, though I was at the moment comfortably reading over a cup of coffee. On the front there were signals for the barrage going up incessantly. Wounded men, limping back, told that the English had penetrated sectors B and C in the support line, and occupied the ground in front of Sector A. Immediately after came the bad news that Lieutenants Forbeck and Grieshaber had fallen while defending their sectors, and that Lieutenant Kastner was badly wounded. At 8:02, Sprenger, till now in temporary command of the 5th Company, came to my dugout with a splinter in his back. After fortifying himself with a pull at the bottle, he went on to the dressing station, quoting, back now, Don Rodrigo." His friend, Lieutenant Domeyer, followed him, bleeding from the hand. Next morning we relieved C Sector, which had meanwhile been cleared of the enemy. There I found pioneers Boyer and Kius with a detachment of the 2nd Company, Gipkins with what remained of the 9th. 8 dead Germans lay in the trench, and 2 English, cap badge, South Africa, Otago Rifles. All had been roughly handled by bombs. Their fearful injuries were written on their faces, distorted by anguish. Both eyes of 2 of them were shot away. While I was greeting Boyer and Kius in our usual tone of ironical pessimism, I felt the look of horror in the eyes of a new recruit, a seminarist, who was gazing at me. Looking along the channel of his thoughts, I had a shock when I realized for the first time how callous the war had made me. One got to regarding men as mere matter. I had men posted at the block and the trench cleared of the dead. At 11:45, without any warning having been given us, our artillery opened out on the position in front of us with the utmost fury. The result was more casualties for us than for the English, and it was not long before the tale of woe opened. The cry for stretchers came along the trench from the left. Hurrying along, I found what was left of my best platoon commander, a shapeless mass in front of the block in the hedge trench. He had had a direct hit in the loins from one of our shells. The fragments of his uniform and clothing, torn from his body by the force of the explosion, were hanging above him on the splintered remnant of a thorn hedge. I had a ground sheet thrown over him to spare the man the sight. Immediately after, 3 more men were wounded at the same spot. One of them had both hands severed at the wrist. He staggered to the rear, covered with blood, both arms resting on the shoulders of a stretcher-bearer. Lance Corporal Ehlers writhed on the ground, stupefied by the explosion. I sent protest after protest to headquarters, vigorously demanding either the cessation of the firing or the presence of artillery officers in the trench. Instead of any reply, a heavy trench mortar joined in with the rest and made the trench an utter shambles. Blood and brains and pieces of flesh were everywhere, and at once collected swarms of flies. At 7:15, I had orders from which I learned that at 7:30 the fire would be increased, that at 8, 2 sections of the storm company were to rush the block in the hedge trench, to roll it up as far as Red Point A, and then to get into touch on the right with a shock troop that was to make an attack parallel with theirs. 2 sections of my company were to follow on and occupy the trench. I made the necessary arrangements with all speed while the artillery fire set in, detailed the 2 sections, and had a word with Lieutenant Voigt, who, a few minutes later, advanced as ordered. I took the matter more as an evening walk than anything else, and strolled along behind my 2 sections, wearing a cap, a stick bomb under my arm. At the moment of the attack, every rifle anywhere near was directed upon the hedge trench. With heads bent, we made jumps from one traverse to the next. In front of us, all went splendidly. The English fled to a line behind, leaving 1 dead. I was bringing up the rear and had just passed the mouth of a trench branching off to the left, when the man ahead of me, an NCO, gave an excited shout and fired past my head to the left. As I could not at all explain his conduct to myself, I went a few steps back and found myself faced, of a sudden, by a powerfully built Englishman, just at the moment when he was lobbing a bomb after the flying NCO. At the same time, shouts rose on all sides. They were coming on over the top to cut us off. I drew forth the bomb, my only weapon, and dropped it at the feet of the Tommy. Then I took to my heels in the direction of our lines. 1 man only, little Wilczek of my company, had the presence of mind to run after me. An egg bomb was thrown after us and tore his belt and the seat of his trousers without doing him any further injury. Voigt and the rest of the men who had gone the other way were apparently surrounded and done for. Continued shouts and explosions of bombs showed that they were selling their lives dearly. In the hope of coming to their help, I led Fahnenjunker Moormann's section forward along the hedge trench. However, we were brought to a stop by a hail of bursting Stokes bombs. A splinter flew against my chest and was caught on the clasp of my braces. Besides this, there was a sudden onset of artillery fire. Fountains of earth were sprayed up out of coloured smoke. The blare of flying metal screamed athwart the blunt roar of heavy shell bursts. The hum of approaching shells came to an end with alarming suddenness. A cloud of splinters sang and whizzed about us. As an attack might be expected, I picked up a helmet and put it on and hurried back with a few men to the trench. Above we saw figures appearing, so we lay down on the edge of the trench and opened fire. Near me, a new recruit was feverishly fingering the trigger of his machine gun without succeeding in getting a shot out of the barrel, till I snatched the thing out of his hands. A few English dropped, the rest disappeared in their trenches again, while the artillery fire grew ever more furious. As for our own, it took sides no longer. While I was walking to my crib, followed by an orderly, something struck the trench wall between us, and, whipping my helmet off my head with enormous force, threw it far away. I thought I had got the whole charge of a shrapnel shell, and lay half stunned in my foxhole. A moment later a shell struck the verge of it, and filled the small space with thick smoke. A long splinter smashed a box of gherkins at my feet. To prevent myself being buried, I crept out into the trench again, and was able, at least, to rouse the two orderlies and my batman, and put them on the lookout. It was a really unpleasant half-hour, and the company had many losses. When the worst of it was over, I went through the trench to take stock of the damage and ascertain what men I had left. As the count of 15 men was not enough for holding the trench, I left the defense of the block to Moorman and 3 men, and withdrew the remainder to a giant shell hole behind our line, and had all the available bombs collected there. My plan was to let the enemy, if they attacked, enter our trench unopposed, and then, at a signal, blow them to bits from above. However, the battle confined itself to an incessant uproar of light trench mortars, rifle grenades, and bombs. On the 27th of July, we were relieved by a company of the 164th Infantry Regiment. We were indeed utterly exhausted. The officer commanding the company was seriously wounded while marching into the line, and a few days later, my crib got a hit and buried his successor. We all breathed more freely when we had left Puisieux behind us, and the rising storm of the final offensive that growled around it. 111th Infantry Division, Divisional Headquarters, 12-8-18. Divisional Orders of the Day. The 73rd Fusilier Regiment has added in the most brilliant fashion to its high reputation as a brave and war-tried unit in the severe fighting which was renewed against an enemy much superior in numbers. I am all the more glad to recognize this, as I well know what high demands in endurance and loyalty to duty in our country's cause must have been made on the troops of the division during this long spell in the line on a difficult front. In particular, Lieutenant Junger earned fresh recognition. Already 6 times wounded, he was, on this occasion, as always, a shining example to both officers and men. Von Busser, Major General and Commander of Division. Storm. On the 30th of July, 1918, we went into rest at Sauchy-l'Estrée, a delightful spot in Artois, surrounded by water. A few days later, we marched still further back to Escaudivre, a small, smug workingman's suburb of Cambrai. I occupied the typical best bedroom of an artisan's house in northern France. The huge double bed has its ominous pied de résistance, a fireplace with hideous red and blue glass vases on the mantelpiece, a round table, chairs, on the walls some of those frightful color prints of the Familistère, Vive la classe, Souvenir de première communion, postcards, and other rubbish. I did what I could to give the right note to my arrival by throwing a pack of cards on the table and my riding boots on the double bed. The clear moonlight nights favored the visits of enemy bombers, who gave us a notion of the overwhelming superiority of material possessed by the other side. Night after night, several formations came over and dropped their bombs of alarmingly high explosives over Cambrai and its suburbs. I was not agitated so much by the fine mosquito-like hum of the engines and the series of reverberating detonations as I was by the dash of my host for the cellar. It is true that one day before my arrival a bomb had landed in front of the windows and flung the gentleman of the house, half-stunned, out of the bed in which I slept, broken a bedpost, and bored the walls of the house with splinters. It was precisely this accident that lulled me into the belief that a repetition of it would be unlikely. After one day's rest, the detested but indispensable round of training set in once more. Drill, instruction, roll calls, lectures, and inspections filled a great part of the day. One entire morning was spent in pronouncing a verdict in a court of honor. Here, too, we were miserably fed. For a long while there was nothing for supper but gherkin, which the men very dryly and aptly named gardener's sausage. It was by no means easy to weld my decimated company into a unit again. It often went against the grain to be always insisting on the details of drill in my relations with the men, convinced though I was of the necessity. Drill as the means to an end is indispensable to every army. It cannot be replaced entirely by individual training, nor by sporting instinct. A man, unless his inherent worth is beyond all doubt, must have obedience drilled into him, so that his natural instincts can be curbed by the spiritual compulsion of his commander, even in the most awful moments. Above all, I devoted my efforts to the training of a shock troop, as it had become more and more clear to me in the course of the war that all success springs from individual action, while the mass of the troops give impetus and weight of fire. Better command a resolute section than a wavering company. I spent my leisure time reading, bathing, shooting, and riding. On my rides I found vast quantities of literature thrown down from aeroplanes. It was designed to hasten the moral deterioration of the army. Among it was even Schiller's poem of Britannia the Free. It seemed to me very clever of the English to bombard us with poetry, and also very flattering to us. A war in which one fought with verses would indeed be a treat. The reward of 30 pfennigs set on the head of each copy by the military authorities showed that they did not undervalue the danger of this weapon. The cost of this, it is true, was laid upon the occupied territory. So it would appear we possessed no longer the wholly pure understanding of poetry. One afternoon I got a bicycle and rode into Cambrai. The dear old town was a desert. Shops and cafes were shut. The streets seemed dead in spite of the field-gray uniforms that thronged them. Monsieur and Madame Plancourt, who had given me such a fine billet a year before, were delighted by my visit. They told me that conditions of life at Cambrai had got worse in every way. They complained particularly of the frequent visits the night bombers paid them. They often had to run downstairs and up again several times a night, disputing the point as they went whether it was better to die in the first cellar by the bomb itself, or in the one lower by being buried alive. The old people's careworn looks made me heartily sorry. A few weeks later, when the town was shelled, they had to leave the house where they had spent their lives at a moment's notice. On the 23rd of August, I was alarmed by violent knocking at my door at 11, when I had sunk into a happy sleep. It was an orderly with marching orders. Already the day before, the monotonous roll and stamp of unusually heavy artillery fire had surged over and warned us on duty, at meals, at cards, to have no illusions about being on rest much longer. We had coined an expressive front-line expression for this distant thunder of guns, es vumet. We packed up in haste and were soon marching on the road to Cambrai in a storm like a cloudburst. Our destination was Marquion, and we reached it at 5 in the morning. The quarters allotted to the company were a farmyard, surrounded by demolished farm buildings, in which each man found shelter as well as he could. I, with my one company officer, Lieutenant Schrader, crept into a little dungeon of brick that had apparently, in more peaceful times, been a goat shed, but was now occupied only by several large rats. At midday there was an officer's powwow, at which we heard that we were that night to take up a position in readiness on the right of the great Cambrai-Bapaume road, not far from Bugny. We were warned that an attack by the new, swift, and more easily maneuvered tanks was probable. I paraded my company in battle order in a small orchard, and then, standing under an apple tree, I said a few words to them as they stood round me in a horseshoe. The expression on their faces was serious and manly. There was little to say. By this time there was not a man who did not know that we were on a precipitous descent, and the fact was accepted with an equanimity that only the moral force, which in every army accompanies its armed force, can explain. Every man knew that victory could no longer be ours, but the enemy should know that he fought against men of honor. On such occasions I took care not to be carried away by a spirit of dare-devilry. It would hardly have been appropriate to show that one looked forward to the battle with a certain joy in the face of men whose dread of death was in many cases increased by anxiety for wife and child. It was also my principle not to raise their courage by big words, nor to threaten the coward. I spoke rather to this effect. I know well enough that no one will leave me in the lurch. We are all afraid, but we must fight against it. To be overcome by one's weakness is only human. At such a moment, look at your leader and your fellows. While I spoke, I felt that what I said went home, and the results justified me in this psychological preparation. Schrader and I had our meal at night on a door laid on a wheelbarrow in the farmyard, and drank a bottle of wine. We then rolled ourselves up in a goat shed till the guard woke us at 2 a.m. with the announcement that the motor lorries were in the marketplace ready to load up. In the ghostly light we rattled over the war-torn country of last year's Cambrai battle, through villages in grotesque states of destruction, with their streets bordered by billows of wreckage. Just before Bugny, we were unloaded and led to our position. The battalion was occupying a hollow on the road Bugny-Vaux. During the morning, an orderly brought orders for the company to push on to the road Prémicourt-Vaux. This typical forward movement made me sure that we were in for it till nightfall. I led my three platoons strung out in file through a country over which aeroplanes circled, dropping bombs and scattering bullets. When we reached our objective, we dispersed in shell holes as an occasional shell came over the road. I felt so bad that day that I lay down at once in a small length of trench and fell asleep. When I awoke, I read Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, and thus the afternoon went by, while I lay in the sun with the apathy of an invalid. At 6:15 a dispatch rider summoned the company commanders to Captain von Weyer. "I have to make the serious announcement that we are to attack. After half an hour's artillery preparation, the battalion will advance at 7 from the western edge of Favreul and storm the enemy lines. You are to march on the church tower of Savigny." After brief coming and going and a hearty handshake, we rushed back to our companies as the artillery fire began in 10 minutes, and we had still a good way to march. By sections in single file, at 20 meters interval, direction half left, treetops at Favrille. A good sign of the spirit that was in the men now, as ever, was that I had to detail one man to stay behind to tell the cookers where to go. No one would volunteer. I walked far ahead of the company with my company staff and Sergeant Major Reinecke. The shots of our guns were bursting out from behind hedges and ruins. Their fire sounded more like a furious yapping than a wave of destruction. Behind me I saw my sections advancing in perfect order. Close to them like dust flew the clouds of shots from aeroplanes. The shrapnel, bullets, empty shells, and driving bands drove with a hellish whir between the files of the thin human line. On the right, Bucatre lay under heavy shell fire, and jagged fragments of iron hurtled heavily overhead and drove with a sudden jab into the clayey ground. Our advance was still more unpleasant behind the Bucatre-Bapaume road. A salvo of HE went up madly behind and before and among us. We scattered and threw ourselves into shell holes. The smoke of shell after shell hung in clouds over the edge of Favrille, and through it rose and fell again brown fountains of earth, one rapidly succeeding another. I went forward alone as far as the first ruined houses to find the way, and then gave the signal with my cane to follow. The village was fringed with badly shelled huts, and there were detachments of the first and second companies assembled by degrees. A machine gun had claimed several victims during the last part of the way. Among others, Vice-Sergeant Major Balg of my company was hit in the leg. A figure in a brown waterproof came quietly across this fire-swept piece of ground and shook hands with me. Kius and Boyer, Captain Juncker, and Schaper, Schrader, Schläger, Heinz, Bent-Eisen, Hurlemann, and Hoppenrock stood behind a hedge that was being raked with lead and iron, and held a great council of war. On many a day of wrath we had fought on one battlefield together, and this time, too, the sun, already low in the west, was to gild the blood of all, or nearly all. Part of the 1st Battalion moved into the park of the chateau. Of the 2nd Battalion only my company and the 5th had come through the curtain of fire practically without casualties. We worked our way forward under cover of shell holes and ruins to a sunken road on the western edge of the village. On the way I clapped on to my head a helmet I picked up, a precaution I never took except in critical moments. I was astonished to find Favrille utterly deserted. Apparently the line of defense had been abandoned by the troops occupying it. Captain von Weyer, now lying alone and severely wounded in a shell hole in the village, had given orders that the 5th and 8th companies were to form the first attacking line, the 6th the second, and the 7th the third. As there was nothing to be seen so far of the 6th and the 8th, I decided to go ahead without bothering too long over the distribution of the attack in depth. It was already 7. Looking from between fragments of houses and stumps of trees, I saw an attacking party advance across the open in 2 waves under moderate rifle fire. It must be the 5th. I drew up my men in the sunken road and gave the order to advance in 2 waves. At 100 meters interval, I myself will be between the 1st and 2nd waves. It was our last storm. How often in years gone by we had stepped out into the western sun in a mood the same as now. Lespage, Guillemont, Saint-Pierre Vast, Langemarck, Parchendale, Meuvre, Vraucourt, Maury. Again, the carnival of carnage beckoned. We left the sunken road quite according to program, only I myself, as the formula of command finally puts it, suddenly found myself near Lieutenant Schrader, far in front of the first wave. Isolated rifle shots rang out in front of us. My cane in my right hand and revolver in the left, I stumped ahead and, without observing it, left the advancing lines of the 5th Company partly behind us and partly on our right. Meanwhile, I found that my iron cross had dropped to the ground from my breast. Shraddha, my Batman, and I began a zealous search for it, in spite of snipers who seemed to be drawing ahead of us. At last, Shraddha extracted it from a tuft of grass, and I fastened it securely on again. The ground began to fall. Indistinct figures were seen in motion against a background of brown earth. A machine gun spat out its bullets at us. A sense of aimlessness took hold of me. Nevertheless, we began to charge at the double. In mid-jump over a piece of trench, a piercing shock through the chest took away my breath. I spun head over heels with a loud cry and fell stunned to the ground. I woke with a sense of great misfortune. I was pinned between narrow walls of earth, and along a row of crouching figures the cry was taken up. "Stretcher-bearers, the company commander is wounded!" An elderly man of another company was leaning over me with a kindly expression, loosening my belt and opening my tunic. Two blood-red circular marks shone out on the middle of my right breast and on my back. I was crippled and chained to earth, and the close air of the narrow trench bathed me in sweat. My good Samaritan revived me by fanning me with my map case. My hope as I struggled for breath was for darkness to come soon, so that I could be carried back. Of a sudden a hurricane of fire broke on us from Sapigny. It was clear that this unbroken roll, this even and regular roaring and stamping, betokened more than a defensive measure against so poorly staged an attack as ours. Above me I could see beneath his helmet Shraddha's strong face, as like a machine he loaded and fired, loaded and fired. A conversation arose between us that recalled the tower scene of the Maid of Orleans. Humorous as it was all the same hardly in my mood, for I had the clear consciousness that I was done. Above rose a cry of horror, and ran from mouth to mouth. "They are through on the left! We are surrounded!" This gave me back my old strength again. I fastened upon a hole that a mole had bored in the trench wall and pulled myself to my feet, while the blood poured from my mouth. With bare head and open coat, I stared, revolver in hand, into the fight. Through whitish swathes of smoke, a row of men with packs came on in a straight line. Some fell and lay there, others turned head over heels like shot hares. 100 meters in front of us, the last were sucked down into the shell-parked earth. They must have been young troops, still unacquainted with the effects of the modern rifle, for they came on with all the hardihood of ignorance. As though drawn by strings, 4 tanks crept over the crest of a rise. In a few minutes our artillery had trodden them into the ground. One broke across like a tin engine. On my right, the brave Moorman collapsed with a cry of death. It did not seem that all was lost. I whispered to Feinrich Wilski to creep to the left and enfilade the gap in our line. He came back almost at once and announced that 20 meters from us the show was up and all were surrendering. It was part of the 99th Regiment there, Zabon. I turned round and saw a strange sight. From the rear there were men coming forward with their hands up. The enemy must already have taken the village from which we went to the attack. The scene became more and more lively. We were surrounded by a circle of Germans and English and called upon to throw down our weapons. I urged those nearest me in a weak voice to fight it out to the death. Friend and foe were fired on alike. Some who surrounded our little band were shouting, some were dumb. On the left, 2 gigantic Englishmen were using their bayonets in a length of trench from which hands were held up imploring mercy. Among us, too, there was heard a tumult of voices. "It's all up. Throw away your rifle. Don't shoot, Kameraden." I looked at the 2 officers who were with me in the trench. They smiled back, and with a shrug, let their belts fall to the ground. There was left only the choice of being taken or being shot. And now the moment had come to show whether all that I had often said to the men when on rest about the fighting spirit was more than empty phrases. I crawled out of the trench and staggered off in the direction of Favrul. Two Englishmen who were taking a haul of prisoners of the 99th Regiment to their own lines barred my way. I shot the nearest one in the middle of the body with my revolver. He collapsed like a dummy figure. The other blazed his rifle at me and missed. These quick movements caused the blood to be driven clear of the lung in deep pulsations. I could breathe more freely and set off at a run over the open beside the trench. Lieutenant Schläger was crouching behind a traverse with a section who were still firing. They joined forces with me. Some English who were going over the open stopped to get a Lewis gun in position and began shooting at us. Except for me, Schläger, and two others, not one escaped. Schläger, who had lost his pince-nez, told me afterwards that he saw nothing but my map case flying up and down. The continuous loss of blood gave me the lightness and airiness of intoxication. One thing only bothered me, that I might collapse too soon. At last we reached a half-moon-shaped earthwork to the right of Favrul, whence half a dozen heavy machine guns were pumping lead on friend and foe without distinction. Enemy shots were spluttering against the parapet. Men danced to and fro in the greatest excitement. An NCO of the Medical Corps attached to the 6th Company tore off my tunic and advised me to lie down at once, as otherwise I might bleed to death in a very few minutes. I was rolled in a ground sheet and carried past the outskirts of Favrul. Some men of my own and the 6th Company went with me. After a few hundred paces we were fired on from the village at close range. The shots went with a smack into the human bodies. The stretcher-bearer of the 6th Company, who carried the rear end of my ground sheet, was laid out with a bullet through the head. I was dropped as he fell. The small detachment had thrown themselves flat on the ground and now crept to the nearest hollow, with bullets dropping into the ground all round them. I lay by myself, firmly secured in my ground sheet, awaiting the coup de grace. And yet, so long as a man of my company lived, I was not quite forsaken. Nearby I heard Lance Corporal Hengstmann's voice. "I'll take you on my back, sir. Either we'll get through it, or, at worst, we'll lie where we fall." Unfortunately, we did not get through. Too many rifles were aimed at us at almost point-blank range. He took me on his back with my arms round his neck, but before we had gone very far there was a metallic report, and Hengstmann sank softly beneath me to the ground. I released myself from his arms that were still clasped under my knees, and found that a bullet had passed through helmet and temples. This brave man was a schoolmaster's son from Letta, near Hanover. This evil precedent did not deter another from coming to my aid, and venturing on a fresh attempt to rescue me. It was Sergeant Strakalski of the Medical Corps. He took me on his shoulders and carried me safely to the blind side of the rise of ground. It was getting dark. The men found the ground sheet of a dead man and carried me over a deserted stretch of ground, over which, far and near, jagged flashes were flaming up. I had to struggle for breath, one of the most painful sensations there are. The smoke of the cigarette that a man was smoking 10 paces in front threatened to suffocate me. At length we reached a dressing station in charge of a friend of mine, Dr. Key. He made me a divine lemon squash, and then put me into a refreshing sleep with an injection of morphine. Next day began the usual journey by stages to the rear. The terrible journey by car to the war hospital brought me to the very edge of the grave. Then I was in nurses' hands. Though I am no misogynist, I was always irritated by the presence of women every time that the fate of battle threw me into the bed of a hospital ward. One sank, after the manly and purposeful activities of the war, into a vague atmosphere of warmth. The clear objectivity of the Catholic nursing sisterhoods afforded a welcome exception. I found with them an atmosphere very congenial to soldiering. My wound was made lighter by many expressions of sympathy, and indeed bodily suffering always increases the sensibility of the inner being. From the Plancos I had a delightful letter, written when the enemy, who were gaining ground very slowly, first began shelling Cambrai. They sent me also a tin of milk they could ill spare, and the only melon their garden had produced. I must not let slip this opportunity of saying that I found many an example among the French civilian population of that internationality of the heart that every decent man and educated soldier ought to uphold. The last of my long series of Batmen, too, was no exception to the rest. He stuck by me, though the hospital allowed no provisions to be made for him, and he had to beg what he could in the kitchen. I amused myself once during the monotonous hours on my back by counting the number of times I had been hit. I found that I had been hit in all 14 times, 6 times by rifle bullets, once by a shrapnel bullet, once by a shell splinter, 3 times by bomb splinters, and twice by splinters of rifle bullets. Counting the ins and outs, this made precisely 20 punctures, so that I might confidently, with that Roman centurion, Hulcian writer, take my place in every warlike circle. Certainly I could at any time assert my claim to belong to one order at least, namely that of the gold wound stripes. This honour did in fact come to me at this very time, though the gold certainly was only yellow lacquered metal. Yet I must confess that I had it sewn on my coat with a certain pleasure. For if doctors and professors, for all their correctness, do not look askance upon the stamp of an official title, why should the soldier refuse a visible sign of his gallantry? The worth of an order, as of everything else, lies not on, but beneath the surface. And who would grudge a heart that has so often beaten fast in the excitement of battle for country's sake the adornment of a bit of enamel as the outward sign? In huckstering times, indeed, when everything turns on money, these things lose their value, for it rests solely within the ideal with which they are bound up. After 14 days I was lying on the feather mattress of a hospital train. Once again a German landscape flitted by me, tinged this time with the first dyes of autumn, and once again, as on that time at Heidelberg, I was gripped by the sad and proud feeling of being more closely bound to my country because of the blood shed for her greatness. Why should I conceal that tears smarted in my eyes when I thought of the end of the enterprise in which I had borne my share? I had set out to the war gaily enough, thinking we were to hold a festival on which all the pride of youth was lavished, and I had thought little, once I was in the thick of it, about the ideal that I had to stand for. Now I looked back. 4 years of development in the midst of a generation predestined to death, spent in caves, smoke-filled trenches, and shell-illumined wastes. Years enlivened only by the pleasures of a mercenary, and nights of guard after guard in an endless perspective. In short, a monotonous calendar full of hardships and privation, divided by the red-letter days of battles. And almost without any thought of mine, the idea of the fatherland had been distilled from all these afflictions in a clearer and brighter essence. That was the final winnings in a game on which so often all had been staked. The nation was no longer for me an empty thought veiled in symbols. And how could it have been otherwise when I had seen so many die for its sake, and been schooled myself to stake my life for its credit every minute, day and night, without a thought? And so, strange as it may sound, I learned from this very 4 years' schooling in force and in all the fantastic extravagance of material warfare that life has no depth of meaning except when it is pledged for an ideal, and that there are ideals in comparison with which the life of an individual and even of a people has no weight. And though the aim for which I fought as an individual, as an atom in the whole body of the army, was not to be achieved, though material force cast us apparently to the earth, yet we learned once and for all to stand for a cause, and if necessary, to fall as befitted men. Hardened as scarcely another generation ever was in fire and flame, we could go into life as though from the anvil, into friendship, love, politics, professions, into all that destiny had in store. It is not every generation that is so favored. And if it be objected that we belong to a time of crude force, our answer is, we stood with our feet in mud and blood, yet our faces were turned to things of exalted worth. And not one of that countless number who fell in our attacks fell for nothing. Each one fulfilled his own resolve. For to every one may be applied the saying from St. John that Dostoevsky put in front of his greatest novel, Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. Today we cannot understand the martyrs who threw themselves into the arena in a transport that lifted them even before their deaths beyond humanity, beyond every phase of pain and fear. Their faith no longer exercises a compelling force. When once it is no longer possible to understand how a man gives his life for his country, and the time will come, then all is over with that faith also, and the idea of the fatherland is dead. And then perhaps we shall be envied, as we envy the saints their inward and irresistible strength. For all these great and solemn ideas bloom from a feeling that dwells in the blood and that cannot be forced. In the cold light of reason, everything alike is a matter of expedience and sinks to the paltry and mean. It was our luck to live in the invisible rays of a feeling that filled the heart, and of this inestimable treasure we can never be deprived. I had the good fortune to be taken out at Hanover and sent to the Clementine Infirmary. One of my companions there was a young flying man of Richthofen's squadron, named Wenzel, who had shot down 12 of the enemy. The last of them had first shot him through the shoulder. On the 22nd of September, 1918, I had the following telegram. His Majesty the Kaiser has bestowed on you the order Pour le Mérite. I congratulate you in the name of the whole division. General von Busser. As soon as I was fit enough, I celebrated this event with Wenzel, my brother, and a few friends. As a doubt had been expressed whether we should soon be passed out fit for active service, Wenzel and I felt ourselves compelled to jump again and again over a large armchair. We came out of it, however, very badly. Wenzel broke his arm again, and I was kept in bed next morning with a temperature of 104. In spite of this, it was not long before we were in excellent form for another winter campaign. This was deferred for a while, and we soon had to take part in other battles than we ever dreamed. Now these, too, are over, and already we see once more in the dim light of the future the tumult of fresh ones. We, by this I mean those of the youth of this land who are capable of enthusiasm for an ideal, will not shrink from them. We stand in the memory of the dead who are holy to us, and we believe ourselves entrusted with the true and spiritual welfare of our people. We stand for what will be and for what has been. Though force without and barbarity within conglomerate in somber clouds, yet so long as the blade of a sword will strike a spark in the night, may it be said, Germany lives, and Germany shall never go under.
Listening to this audio connoisseur production. We are dedicated to bringing the world's finest literature to an audience of discriminating listeners. This production was narrated by Charlton Griffin.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.